rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. War on the West. Krieg gegen den Westen. Unter diesem Titel seziert Jan Buruma, der anglo-niederländische Autor und Kommentator, die aktuellen Attacken von innen und von außen auf die liberale Demokratie und ganz generell die Lage der Welt. Jan Buruma ist ein Star und ein linksliberaler Vordenker für Europa und Amerika. Er hat unter anderem die angesehene New York Review of Books geleitet. Im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum hat Außenpolitik-Expertin Eva Novotny mit Jan Buruma einen großen Bogen gezogen. Vom rechten Populismus und der Mitverantwortung der Linken über das autoritäre Modell China bis zu den verheerenden Angriffen auf die Demokratie durch die Rechten in den USA. Es ist ein geistreicher Tour d'Horizon. Zu Beginn erklärt Jan Buruma den historischen Hintergrund des von ihm gewählten Titels »War on the West«. Gemeint ist vor allem der Westen, wie er sein sollte, liberal, demokratisch und multikulturell.
Well, I do remember why I chose the title War on the West. And it was because there's a famous book, famous although pretty much forgotten everywhere. It was once famous, called War on the West. And it was by a Hungarian, originally Jewish Hungarian, I think from Budapest, who moved to England in the 1930s. He was a philosopher called Orel Kolnai, and he became a Catholic and rather conservative, although not right-wing. And he wrote this book in 1937, and it was he did us all a great service because he ploughed through all the writings by right-wing intellectuals, in mostly in Germany and Austria, of the 1920s and early 30s, who were not necessarily Nazis, but people who laid the basis for what the Nazis later did. So people like Müller von den Bruck and so on. And he called it War on the West because of a lot of nationalist writing during World War I, including by Thomas Mann, where there was a contrast made between the West, which was basically identified with Britain, the United States, and France. And they were liberal, they were open to immigrants, they had a very loose sense of national identity. They were, from the point of view of these people who wrote these things, they were materialistic, only interested in money, etc. And the East, in their view, were the people who understood the values of Blutenboden and who had a spirit and a national soul and so on and so forth. And this was particularly strong in World War I and then, of course, became very popular in the 1920s and 30s and then in its extreme form became National Socialist. And I was very impressed when I first read this book because it made a lot of sense because what he was really describing was not so much the West as it is, because the West is many things. I mean, it's conservative, liberal, tolerant, intolerant, etc., etc. But it described through the eyes of its enemies an idea of the West, and an idea of the West that was associated with liberalism, with free market economy, with very often, of course, Jews. And when Avishai Margalit, the Israeli philosopher, and myself wrote a book called Occidentalism, and that was called, the subtitle was The West Seen Through the Eyes of Its Enemies, it was widely misunderstood by people who assumed that what we were, even people who much approved of the book, I think often for the wrong reasons, who assumed that what we were talking about was the West as some existing geographical, cultural phenomenon, and people from the Middle East and Asia and so on, which was, of course, not our intention. It was to describe a particular idea of the West, and the people who hated it so much that they wanted to commit violence. And I think what this article refers to is that idea of the West is once again in danger and being very much squeezed, as was true, of course, in the 1920s in Europe, being squeezed between left-wing anti-liberalism as well as right-wing anti-liberalism.
When I was looking at your list of publications in bibliography, I found and I was interested in one of the books that you had published with the title Year Zero, 1945. Right. And it caused me to think, because in a way I have the feeling that we are now again in some kind of zero year. Yeah. A year which is a sort of a turning point in so many respects. And 1945 was the starting point for a development in a very positive direction. Multilateralism, international institutions, democratization, human rights regimes, some kind of rule of law, and a system of global governance that served the whole world very well. And now, at the moment, we have arrived in a situation where this may be the starting point of a big unraveling, where all these achievements are put into question, where multilateralism is put in question, international institutions are ignored or under attack, human rights, democracy, I mean, things are going in backwards in a way.
Yes, I agree with you, but I don't think it started this year. I think it's becoming perhaps more dramatic, but that unraveling started earlier, I think. And the reason it was relatively positive in 1945, which was not a particularly positive time for most people to live through, but it was still full of hope, was because what came before couldn't have been worse. And so the shock of World War II and what had happened and the wreckage of Europe and China and East Asia and so on meant that people felt that, well, this never again. And so we have to build institutions that make sure that that kind of catastrophe can't occur again. And that led to, indeed, a kind of consensus between sort of moderate conservatives and social democrats. I mean, the left and the right both felt that it was a good thing to build a world where this would no longer be possible. And so indeed, multilateral institutions, beginning of European unification. I mean, one thing when I researched that book that struck me very much was that I came across in the library a magazine that may not exist anymore, but it was a magazine written and edited by American GIs for American soldiers. It was a magazine called Yank. And the articles in this magazine, Yank, were way to the left of the Democratic Party today. In terms of racial relations, in terms of rights and human rights, and economic equality, and so on. So this is an illustration of that the whole world was then sort of going in a left-wing, moderate left-wing direction. And I think what in some ways kept that alive, perhaps perversely, is the Cold War. Because in order to counter communist propaganda, which was in the late 40s and 50s still quite influential in intellectual circles, certainly in countries like France and Italy, the West or the Western democracies needed to have some idea, some common goal of egalitarianism. I mean, that you can't allow societies to get too divided between left and right and so on. There had to be a counter narrative to the communist world that showed that the capitalist Western world could also be egalitarian. And I think one of the unintended consequences of the end of the Soviet Empire in 1990-91 was that ideal was very quickly jettisoned, and because people felt it was no longer really necessary. It could all be left to the free market now. And that, of course, also had an earlier history. It really began in the period of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, when there was a reaction to too much union power, and a resurgence of a certain kind of nationalism, kind of fetishism of the free market and so on, which in those days was very much something that came from Britain and America but had an influence in other Western democracies. And after the fall of the Soviet Empire, really became not everywhere in the same to the same extent, certainly not to the same extent in Austria or Germany or France than it did in the United States or Britain, but it sort of became the consensus. And this is, of course, what now people call neoliberalism. And when the common ideal of egalitarianism was thrown away, to put it in a way that's a little bit of a caricature, the left lost its purpose. And when the left lost its purpose, and conservatism and free market fetishism sort of became the mainstream, I think that did great damage to liberal democracy. And what we see now, the rise of right-wing populism, the Trump administration, and so on, wouldn't have happened if there had still been a strong left. So it's not just the rise of the right that needs to be explained. What also needs to be explained is the demise or the crash of the left, and we can talk about that too. But
I think we should. Yes, I mentioned this example of the year zero, because in a way it seems to me that the war that we are facing now in Europe, Russia's attack on Ukraine, is a change of paradigm. Yeah, and we have for the whole sort of post-war period, it was one of the dogmas that you do not attack another country. Yeah, and we have the whole system that we built up around this principle. OSCE, Organization of Security Cooperation in Europe, Helsinki process, and so was based on that you do not change borders with military violence, that you respect the sovereignty of other countries, and in a way, this attack has crystallized in a way so many things. Or brought clearer so many things that were already there, which of course you rightly said, and I sometimes think that I mean, we have overcome the Cold War in its classical form, yeah? So the West against the old Soviet Empire and the countries that were under communist control and rulers and leadership. But we are moving into a Cold War in a different composition, in a way.
Yes.
The countries are... It's more sort of now the countries that are embracing capitalist market economy, but combine it with authoritarian rule and are doing quite well with it. And of course, for many, this is a very attractive concept that you are successful, you accumulate wealth, you offer social services, but you don't have to deal with freedom of information, human rights, and all these other issues. It's a concept that appeals in many parts of the world, and that's, I think, the new confrontational lines that we are facing.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, we shouldn't forget, of course, that the tanks, Soviet and East German tanks rolled into Hungary and Prague and so on before.
We were there, yes.
There were wars in the Balkans as well, so it's not completely unprecedented. I think in response to your remarks, I would say two things. One is that, yes, we seem to be facing a very new world and paradigms shift and so on and so forth. On the other hand, you can't help seeing how long the shadow of World War II still is. First of all, both the Russians and some people who are supporting Ukraine are claiming to be fighting Nazis. I mean, the Russians claim they're fighting Nazis in the Ukraine. Some supporters of the Ukraine sort of project Putin as a Hitler, and that we're supporting the Ukraine is like fighting the Third Reich. You see a split, an old split, going right through Europe of Britain and America being most vociferous and most hawkish about fighting Russia and helping Ukraine and so on, blaming Macron because he keeps trying to talk to Putin, and blaming Olaf Scholz for being too slow to support Ukraine and seeing them as sort of appeasers. So you get the old divisions that were already there in World War II. And it only shows that it's very difficult to escape history, even when things look so new. The other thing I would say is that I think you're absolutely right that this model of authoritarian capitalism is a new challenge. And it was a challenge that was not posed by the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union was not seen as a serious economic competitor. The West didn't do business of any scale with the Soviet Union, and it was a relatively weak and poor country. I mean, they had nuclear bombs and so on, but it was not a serious economic force. I would say the pioneers of this model are not in Europe, but it's China.
Of course.
And the model for China is Singapore. And Singapore is a small city state, so it's easy to have a kind of authoritarian system with democratic trappings, which is still basically capitalist. But Deng Xiaoping, when he opened the door to China for international business and wanted to introduce a kind of capitalism while retaining the monopoly on power by the Communist Party, Singapore was really the model. And in Singapore, they pretended in a self-serving way, or Lee Kuan Yew did, that this was somehow natural to Asians. And in Singapore, they talk about Asians because they don't want, if they say the Chinese, then they discriminate against the Malay minority. So they can't say that this is a Chinese culture, but they call it Asian. In any case, they abuse the notion of Chinese civilization, of Confucianism, and pretend that this is that obeying authority and so on is somehow the natural cultural thing. But what they've come up with is a hybrid between Chinese authoritarianism based on, an abuse of history by invoking Confucianism and Chinese culture and what used to be called Asian values and so on, and capitalism. And, of course, it works up to a point. I think people underestimate its inherent weakness, which is that the claim to legitimacy or the legitimacy of monopolizing political power by the Communist Party is not based on Marxist ideology or Maoist ideology, because even communists in China don't believe that anymore. So it's based on the idea of order, of national greatness, and promising the educated urban middle class that they will continue to become more prosperous. Now, that's a very risky and slippery basis for political legitimacy, because it means that as soon as the urban middle class are no longer becoming more prosperous, but in a serious crisis might even see their savings disappear, political legitimacy will be challenged. And in a democracy, you can vote the party out that you blame for this, not in a dictatorship. But they are the model, and clearly a lot of authoritarian leaders around the world find this attractive, because it means that people become your friends and family and more people than that, particular class of educated people can be relatively prosperous, and yet you hang on to authoritarian power.
But how far that the control, the rigid control of the population goes, we have just seen now in a very vivid example with the lockdown of Shanghai and the partial lockdown of quotes in Beijing. As a consequence of the corona infections, yeah? And I think it was, I remember one of the most horrifying pictures of that whole thing was from Shanghai, where you had totally empty streets and the only thing that was moving was a little robot dog who was walking the streets and announcing curfew to the people. No people.
Not only announcing curfew, they had loudspeakers saying, "Contain the freedom of your heart." Yes, it was very chilling.
And the consequences for the whole sort of global economy, supply lines, transport, and so on, are horrendous.
Yes, absolutely, and it shows the weakness of an autocratic government like that. Once you've dictated a certain policy, it's very difficult to change. First of all, you can't get voted out, and secondly, you feel that it's a challenge to your authority if you suddenly embark on a different policy. So it's the other thing. I mean, the telling people to contain the freedom in their heart, of course, is an interesting slogan. I'm paraphrasing. I think it was something slightly different, but it's something that Maoists would never have said, because they weren't interested in freedom in people's hearts. They were not interested in freedom at all. They were interested in other things. And what this model that you mention of autocratic capitalism does, and it's a very clever model, which is that it allows prosperous individuals a lot of personal freedom, unlike in Maoism or even in the Soviet Union. You can live where you want, you can marry who you want, you can go to nightclubs, you can travel to Europe as a tourist, you can buy a Maserati, you can do all these things. But the one thing you can't do is organize anything that's not under control of the party. And that means that people have no political freedom whatsoever, but they have a lot of personal freedom, and that means that the people who are relatively well off in these systems will become conservative, because they want to hold on to those privileges, and they're frightened of sort of mass movements and so on, and they're even you can convince them that democracy is dangerous because it will create disorder and the uneducated masses who are, will cause problems, and it'll cause create violence and so on. And so if you want to hold on to your nice Volkswagen, or indeed in some cases Maserati, if you want to hold on to your nice apartments and the order that is guaranteed by the party in order for you to have a nice life, you'd better do as we say. And that's, again, as long as the urban educated classes do all right, that's a fairly stable system. It's no longer stable, in my view, when people do not no longer do all right. And so COVID is probably a real problem for the Communist Party. But I've been saying for the last 20 years that the Chinese Communist Party was vulnerable, and they're still there. So I probably overestimated their vulnerability.
We don't necessarily have to look at China. I mean, we are also in Europe confronted with the, what you call it, the authoritarian temptation. Yeah? We have Hungary and the Orban government flirting with what they call illiberal democracy, which in my opinion is contradictio in adjecto, because democracy cannot be illiberal. I mean, this doesn't go together. But you have Turkey, you have a very authoritarian shift in Poland. And finally, I mean, you have certain phenomena also in the United States that are troublesome in that respect.
Yes, I mean, that's complicated, because I think the reasons for these illiberal trends are not necessarily the same in each country.
They are different in each
country. I mean, I think in Central Europe, a lot of it is because people were promised after 1989 and 1990, now you will join the EU and you'll be just as prosperous as all those Western Europeans, and everything is going to be wonderful and so on. And of course, it didn't turn out that way. And so there's a great resentment of the EU, of people who promised that, and there's a backlash. People want strong men and become nationalistic and so on and so forth. I mean, Turkey has its own problems, and I'm not competent to talk about that in any detail. In America, it's a little bit more like Europe, although more dramatic, in that as a consequence, I think, of what we were talking about earlier, the collapse of the left, when the mainstream became, just to use that as that jargon word, but neoliberal, and things were left up to the market, there was no real ideological difference, or not sufficient ideological difference, between what was traditionally more or less left of center or right of center. And you got in more and more countries in Europe what in Holland, where I grew up, is called the purple government. So a sort of social democrat and conservative government, parties being in government together. You couldn't really tell them apart anymore. And to a lot of people who felt that they were not benefiting from this, that their salaries were stagnating, that their children were no longer going to be better off than the parents, that immigrants were coming in and the elites were blamed for being more generous to the immigrants than they were to the local population, when the EU was blamed often by national governments for their own self-serving reasons for all the hardships that people were going through, resentment started building. And when the resentment was voiced by people who saw immigrants coming to their neighborhoods, who saw their children failing at school, who saw their jobs disappearing and so on, it was very easy to blame it all on the elites. And when you blame in Europe, when you blame it on the elites, you blame it on the EU, because that's seen as an elite project. You blame it on the immigrants, you blame it on the left that's supposedly coddling the immigrants, and you end up with right-wing populism. And something similar has happened in the United States, but in an even more dramatic form. In America, of course, race plays an even bigger role than it does in Europe. But of course you have to blame the right for exploiting this, but I blame the left too. And I think one of the big, it's difficult to call it a mistake because these things grow gradually, but one of the problems of the left in Europe and the United States is that they've let go of class and looking after the economic interests of a certain class, and more replaced it with cultural issues, with gay rights, with gender issues, with multiculturalism, none of which are bad causes. I mean, you know, I'm in favor of gay rights and so on. But when that more or less replaces class and economic interests, then you end up in a culture war. And when you end up in a culture war, people who are not on the left start their own culture war. And stressing again, coming back to your first question, coming back to Bluten-Boden. And so I think the culture war is a disaster for democracy, or liberal democracy.
But we are not only in the United States, also in Europe, we're in the middle of that controversy. And the question is, where do you go from there? Yeah, I mean, in the United States, you have, I think the situation is even a little more difficult perhaps than in Europe because of that two-party system that in the way politics are handled, yeah, mm-hmm. enforces very radical positions on both sides, yeah. While in England is an exception, but most of the European countries have multi-party systems which dilute in a way a little bit these tensions and offer more room for channeling.
That is true, positions. But that has its own weakness, which is, I mean, the strength of that, as you say, is that you can form a cordon sanitaire against the really radical right parties. You can prevent them from ever becoming part of the government by having coalitions of parties who have very little in common, except they want to keep the right out. But that's a short-term solution. I mean, the resentment that drives the far right will only get worse because of that, because it strengthens the feeling we are not only left behind, we're kept out of power or kept down, it's these elites and they have to be, etc. So it's not. I agree with you that in the short term that makes you feel a little bit safer in Europe than it does in the United States, but it doesn't solve the problem. What I think would go some way to solving the problem is to go back to economic interests. And I think Joe Biden actually started off on the right note, which was he may have been too ambitious, he may not have sold it properly, all that, but I think he had the right idea to try and have another New Deal, which would benefit immigrants just as much as the local population that were not doing very well. And so it's no good if you're a left-wing party to say, oh, well, we have to be nice to immigrants and we shouldn't be anti-racist and we have to appreciate their cultures and we should encourage mosques and so on, all of which, none of which are bad things. But I think it would be much better to try and point out that certain economic policies would benefit immigrants just as much as the local working class, so that you get a real sense of solidarity between the working class and immigrants. That's hard to do, but you have to try and do that. Whereas what we have now, again, you see it in America so clearly, is that the poor white people see immigrants and black people and so on as enemies, whereas they actually share a lot of problems and have a lot of problems in common. And so you find that poor white people making common cause with a billionaire, surrounded by sort of cronies who are extremely rich, doing things to become even richer, and selling and persuading these poor whites, or relatively poor whites, that somehow they're benefiting because you're fighting for their culture. But that's, again, a reason why I think the sooner we get away from the culture wars and the more we get back to class and economics, the better. I mean, I was never a socialist in my life, and in the 70s and 80s, I sort of slightly reacted against leftists in Europe as a form of rebellion against the 68 generation. Having lived in America now for almost 20 years, I've become much more left-wing than I ever was before, but in the classical sense.
It's nice to welcome you in the group of leftist thinkers, especially here in this house. I was thinking when you spoke about sort of the problems in the multi-party system. Yeah. I lived for a couple of years in France, and it was that time when sort of Father Le Pen was sort of on the rise for the movement, and in the Parti Socialiste, as well as with the Conservative Party, Chirac and so on, the dogma was keep them out of power at all costs. And they were sacrificing electoral victories, I mean, just to keep out a Le Pen follower and so on. And it didn't work because at the moment, the movement is with 40% and shows that this was not the right answer. Yeah?
No, it
and
doesn't work.
I think
work.
Probably yeah. Going back to sort of economic issues, basic economic issues, might be a more solid
especially answer. Since the far right and the Le Penists are good examples of this, but so is Trump, and rhetorically at least, they've hijacked a lot of the economic issues from the left. So, you always, of course, had a distinction between right-wing populism and left-wing populism, but what they have in common is that they aren't anti-elitist. But the left-wing populists were, of course, against bankers and financiers and so on, but so is the right. I mean, it's not National Socialism for nothing. And so once the left lets go of those economic issues, it gets hijacked by the right, which is yet another reason why the left should try and get it back.
But that's why it's so tragic that, in a way, Biden failed to bring that big economic revival project that he had with infrastructure and so on through Congress and really get the money to do it.
Well, he still got more through than, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but more through than either certainly Trump or even Obama did. I mean, Obama got the health care through.
Yeah.
But one shouldn't underestimate what Biden has actually achieved. I mean, he's not really given enough credit, I think.
There was yesterday an article by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times.
He's not my guru.
So he's not everybody's guru. But nevertheless, it was a very personal kind of sort of commentary that he wrote about the lunch that he had with Biden.
Yeah, that was him at his worst. Mm-hmm. When he gets personal, that's rarely when he's irritating.
No, but he then concluded the article by saying that sort of Biden was successful in sort of keeping NATO together. He was successful in keeping Europe together. He was successful in keeping the West together. But that he is very concerned that he was not keeping the United States together, and that the breaking lines and the fissures in the society so great.
That goes to show that he's a master of the cliché. But the main point of these articles is to say that he had lunch with President Biden.
And Biden
listened to his advice.
And he had a tuna sandwich.
They had a tuna sandwich too.
No, but I mean, on a more serious note, I think the one of the biggest problems that the United States is facing is this constant attack on voting rights and the fooling around with the electoral system. I remember when I was still in Washington, I met members of Congress who were proud that in their whole political life they never had an opponent, because the majorities were so solidified that they were re-elected and re-elected and re-elected, and there was never a question of a political shift. And if you have a parliament, and Congress is after all a parliament too, where only 10% of the seats can be changed in an election, this puts a big question mark whether this is really sort of a bona fide democratic system.
Yes, of course, both parties do this.
Yes.
And some of the oldest democracies, I mean, Britain particularly, have had these kind of practices forever. I mean, you had the so-called rotten boroughs, and corruption has always been there. I'm less worried about corruption than I am about a direct attack on democratic institutions and democracy itself. I mean, what should have disqualified Donald Trump from the beginning was when he said, I think in the first presidential debate, may have been in the second one, but I think the first one, and he was asked the question, would he accept the outcome of the election? And he said, well, that depends on what the outcome is. And that should have disqualified him. I mean, you cannot be a president in a liberal democracy if you're not prepared to accept electoral defeat.
Yes.
And if you're not prepared to accept electoral defeat, the system won't work. And that's much more dangerous. I mean, it's bad enough, all the fooling around with electoral districts and that kind of gerrymandering. But it's really catastrophic when you manage to convince a large number of people who vote for one of the two main political parties that the outcome of an election is illegitimate. Because if you say that, then the whole system is illegitimate.
Yeah, but that's why you have the sort of Damocles is a big lie.
Yes.
It's still hanging or poisoning
but when
the political
you were saying,
debate.
When you were
if you
saying,
have so many, such
sure.
a high percentage of the population that is still, even today, convinced that the election of Biden was illegitimate and that it was only by fraud. And so that poisons the political system completely.
Of course. No, absolutely. So I think, you were saying democracy can't exist without liberalism. That depends on what you mean by democracy. I mean, some people on the far right believe that real democracy is direct democracy with referendums and that kind of thing. That's when you get the voice of the people. And whereas liberal democracy is a variation. I mean, we all know this. I mean, it's representative and so on. And you can have a lot of corruption and fooling around, and the liberal democracy can survive that, but not if half the voters don't believe the system works.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
We are also having an occasional debate about politics by referendum and sort of die Volksmeinung, yeah, but we are still holding on to the representational democracy and representational system. It works in Switzerland, but it's the only country that I know where this kind of political system really works and where people are very serious about what they are doing.
Yes.
And not influenced by political populist maneuvering or less influenced than anybody else. But I need to go back to sort of our more perhaps burning issue at the moment is the relationship between Europe and the United States per se. We came in a way through the Trump years, yeah, with a lot of problems and a lot of misgivings on both sides and misunderstandings and so on. Biden has straightened it out to a certain extent, yeah? And we are back, and in a way, Friedman is right that he said Biden has kept us together in the transatlantic relationship. But we are having midterm elections now, in 2 years presidential elections, and if all predictions are taken seriously, it's not unlikely that Mr. Trump will have a return to power.
Well, first of all, I don't think we should take predictions seriously because we just don't know. I mean, politics, I mean, I don't want to sound like Friedman, but
it was in this house that Shimon Peres once said, and that's a remarkable sentence, he said, opinion polls are like perfume. They smell nice, but don't drink them.
Right, exactly. So we don't know. I mean, we don't know whether Trump will be the candidate. All kinds of things can still happen. But the President of the United States is an immensely powerful figure, and it is indeed possible that he could come back, and that would, again, challenge all those things that Biden has been trying to put together. There's no question. And you already see in different parts of the world countries anticipating this. In East Asia, for example, there was because of the war in the Ukraine, the Taiwanese, among others, are getting very anxious that China might be tempted to do something similar. They didn't really take their defense terribly seriously, like everywhere else. The young people that would much prefer to have fun than to be conscripted into the army. They're beginning to change this very fast, and they're talking about having conscription again. There was an opinion poll, and for the first time, less than 50% of the Taiwanese population thought that America would come to their rescue in the case of a Chinese invasion. And that is because of Trump. People realize that if Trump comes back, things could go very badly wrong again. And in some ways, it's a necessary wake-up call, in my view. I mean, it's a very harsh and dangerous and risky wake-up call, but it was a necessary one. Because, again, to go back to 1945, the deal behind the world order that was created then, at least in the non-communist world, was the United States will take care of our security, whether you were Japanese or Dutch or Austrian or British. The United States will take care of our security. We don't have to worry about that too much. We can concentrate on rebuilding our economies and being prosperous and wealthy and so on. And that made us all sort of into adolescence, that we resent the dependence on our father and we want to kick him in the shin at every opportunity. And this is not a healthy situation, especially now that most Europeans are more prosperous than most Americans. So it's also not for nothing, and Trump understood this very well, that many Americans can be talked into feeling resentful that their tax dollars go into paying for protecting Europeans and Japanese and Koreans and so on, even though those people being protected are not pulling their weight and are dependent on us. And again, for a good liberal democracy to function, there has to be a certain sense of responsibility for your own security. You can't be completely dependent on the United States forever. This is not a good situation. And it could be that Trump, and now Ukraine, has woken up Europeans and some and East Asians sufficiently that they will take seriously this idea of paying more for our defense, for being more independent. We can't cut ourselves off from the United States, certainly not yet, but it'll be very difficult, but it's absolutely essential that Europeans start thinking seriously about this. And by Europeans, I mean in particular the Germans, because without Germany, nothing will really change. And so, having grown up in the Netherlands only a few decades after the war, feels very peculiar to be saying this, but you know, I want Germany to become a more serious military power again. I would never thought I would think that when I was younger, but I really do. And I think it's a real problem that, I mean, it's changing now. And the attitude of the Greens in this war is very, very interesting. So things are beginning to change. And I think for very bad reasons, war and so on, but that is perhaps one positive aspect, that it's made countries that were too dependent on the United States think a little bit more responsibly.
In a way, Trump was the first wake-up call in that respect. And when he said and came out with statements like sort of Europe is an enemy and NATO is obsolete, and that was a shock for Europe. And in some respects, a very healthy shock, because we started to confront these issues. And as a consequence of the present war situation, the security debate, in Europe has become much more stronger. And it was always there. Mm. And as you know, I mean, things in the European Union particularly move very slowly and go in phases and so on. But the basis has been laid for a common European security system, common European defense. It will take time, I mean, till it all materializes. And how serious that whole issue is taken at the moment, you see by the sudden switch in the Nordic defense position, where Sweden and Finland seek entry into NATO after generations and generations of non-alignment and being alliance free. And we have the same debate here in Austria about what is, are we still keeping on as a neutral country? Is this a concept which is conducive to our security, or do we have to change it? I mean, so the debate is ripe. And as you said, should it turn out that Trump comes back into the presidency, it will get a lot of push.
It's one more reason why Brexit was such a disaster, because you can't conceive of any kind of European security, common security arrangement without Britain. I mean, Britain and France are the only countries that have any, not nearly serious enough, but any at least some kind of serious defense. And without Britain, it can't be done. And again, politics are being played in this Ukraine war, in that Boris Johnson, who likes to posture as the sort of Churchill of his time, which makes him look pretty absurd, but one of the ways he does it is by grandstanding in Kyiv and other places, and projecting this image, which is not entirely wrong, of that once again it's the English-speaking countries and now with the Scandinavians who are standing up for freedom against a dictator and so on, whereas the Germans and the French, and they still want to talk and pretend that, you know, everything can be done peaceful in a peaceful way and so on. All these are caricatures, but there's a kernel of truth to it. And so the more Britain is integrated into the EU, and one can only hope that after Boris Johnson and the Brexiteers, Britain will come to its senses and they'll come to some kind of, if not rejoin, at least to some a better, a closer arrangement. Because without that, I don't see much hope.
Well, in many different respects, Brexit was a disaster. It was very detrimental for the European Union, but it's also, I mean, a disaster for Britain. I remember that you had, not so long ago, an article in Project Syndicate about the relationship, about the consequences of Brexit and the relationship between the United States and Britain.
Well, the Churchill Complex was a book, and it's. I was trying to argue that in some ways, in almost every respect, it was a very good thing that the Allies won the war, and Austria was the first victim of Nazi Germany, but it had its unfortunate consequences, which is that. Britain stuck to the United States like a leech instead of playing a major role in the EEC and then the EU, because it hung on to its hour of glory and thought that by sticking to the United States it could still be a major power, and that the national glory was having defeated Nazi Germany and Japan and the United States in particular, but usually followed by Britain loyally, embarked on a lot of stupid wars because presidents tended to see themselves, wanted to be Churchill and not Attlee, or not Chamberlain. And so the two countries in some ways suffered from having been the victors in World War II. Whereas in Germany, of course, the consequences was very different. There they still suffer because they feel that they can just concentrate on being prosperous and having a good life and talking about peace and love without having to be responsible for their security and being frightened of it. So again, it shows how historical events shape the future and how difficult it is to get away from those events. I mean, Austria's neutrality, or carefully cultivated neutrality, no doubt has a lot to do with Austria's history. Certainly. In the 20th century.
Certainly. It was the result of... It was neutrality that brought back sovereignty, independence... separated Austria from the German question,
right,
and got the foreign troops out of the country.
Yes.
And in a way, then it went through several phases, which we do not get into that discussion,
right,
here now.
Right.
But at the moment, we are in the situation that about close to 90% of the population are deeply attached to the status of neutrality.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to...
Well, it's a very comfortable...
Any other,
it's
any
a very
other
comfortable concept. Situation to
yes.
be in.
Yeah. Which does not mean that we have not played our role also, modest as it is, in the building up a European security system. We are members of PESCO and we are sending troops. We are still in the Balkans and so on. So we do... Modestly, but nevertheless, we are doing our share. Yeah, but in the broader picture of the whole transatlantic relationship, which is extremely solid, if you look at it purely in the economic issues. Yeah, when you that there's nothing, there is no other economic relationship which is as strong as the relationship between the United States and Europe. In every respect, that's trade, that's foreign direct investment, jobs, whatever aspect you look at. But in every other respect, I mean, the role of Britain in that relationship was instrumental over the years, and in a way that Britain broke out of the European Union and the consequences of Brexit also in this relationship are felt.
Yes, that's true, but one can also overrate the role of Britain in this, in that Britain took the relationship with America much more seriously than America took the relationship with Britain. I mean, there are certainly, there's a lot of cooperation in intelligence and that kind of thing left over from the war, and this, you know, they speak a similar language and all the rest of it. But from quite a long time ago, I mean, President Kennedy still confided in Harold Macmillan and saw him as a sort of father figure and was an Anglophile of a kind, perhaps as a form of rebellion against his father, who was an Anglophobe. But from Johnson onwards, really, the Americans took Germany probably more seriously than Britain. Germany was the major power in Europe, not Britain. I mean, there was nostalgia and, you know, Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump, and they like going horse riding with the Queen and all that kind of thing. But that's not serious. And I think when the Americans were serious, and that was true, think of after the Gulf, I think it was after the Gulf War, the first capital in Europe that George H.W. Bush visited was not Britain, it was Bonn still at the time. And so Germany was considered to be the major power, and the Americans wanted Britain always to be the kind of the middleman, wanted Britain to be in Europe as the sort of the country that understood America best and all that. But apart from Donald Trump, for his own perverse reasons, no American president would have condoned, certainly not Ronald Reagan either, Britain leaving European institutions in the way they did. But I think it's probably done the most damage to Britain itself, Brexit that is, but in terms of security, it's, well, economics too, but it's certainly done a lot of damage to Europe as well.
Yes. I can cite you one example where Europeans have become very resentful of the special relationship between Britain and the United States, and that was in Washington, where the British embassy and its diplomats had special passes which enabled them to go into the State Department without any security checks and sort of complete free access and free movement, while the rest of us always had to apply appointment, wait, security checkup, and so forth. So there was a lot of grumbling here about the special relationship.
I wonder if that's still true today. I'd be slightly surprised.
No, I think that's...
But yeah, there are those perks, but they sort of feel a bit like, you know, Ronald Reagan riding his horse with the Queen. I mean, there are these nostalgic leftovers, but I don't think the relationship was, for a long time, has been taken very seriously by Washington. I mean, the language. I mean, for example, Obama wrote a book, and I can't remember the title now, not about his own background and so on, but he wrote a book about foreign policy in which Britain is only mentioned once. And it's especially the British themselves rarely overrate, I think, the importance of this special relationship.
I would agree, and I think now, Even the American politicians know that they have to go to Brussels if they want anything in Europe. And Biden has been doing that very well, and Anthony Blinken as well.
Well, it was Kissinger who said that the problem with Europe is you didn't know who to call.
The famous phone number.
Yeah, and so...
In the meantime, they know...
So that often went through London, and that's no longer true, but I don't think that the problem is so severe anymore. I mean, I think they do know who to call.
They don't know who to call, and they don't know where to go.
And the first call is usually to the German Chancellor.
Das war ein Gespräch mit dem Buchautor und Kommentator Jan Boruma mit Eva Novotny im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum vom 24. Mai 2022. Beim Kreisky-Forum bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW zuhören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Die intellektuellen Debatten unserer Zeit finden im Falter regelmäßig ihren Niederschlag. Ein Abonnement des Falter können Sie im Internet bestellen, über die Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Im Namen des gesamten Teams verabschiede ich mich, bis zur nächsten Folge.
Sie hörten das Falterradio, den Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.